Hello, and welcome to Exiting the Cave, a podcast dedicated to sharing philosophical insights, the practice of epistemic humility, and generally learning how to look directly into the sun. My name is Greg Gauthier, and I'm an amateur philosophy geek. I'll be your host on this journey. I hope you enjoy it. The Categories is Aristotle's first attempt to outline a theory of being, in addition to the work's central focus, which is to provide an account of the ways in which we think about being and beings. In total, there are 10 categories of thought about being, but the core of his theory of being begins with the first category. This is what he calls substance. This essay will summarize Aristotle's conception of substance as he presents it in the categories, briefly explain what distinguishes substance from the other categories, and offer some additional thoughts about the metaphysics of being in relation to Aristotle's mentor, Plato. So what is substance? In what does substance consist, and what sets it apart from other categories? The first two questions can be answered together. Once we're clear on that, we can move on to the last question. To answer the first two questions, we need to make a distinction. Our first step will be to substitute a synonym for the word substance, being. When Aristotle talks about substance in the categories, he primarily means to ask what it means to be. From this substitution, it should be relatively easy to see the two senses in which he wants to use the word substance. First, the space within which things can be. In other words, the state of being itself. Second, the individual beings that occupy that space of being itself. Aristotle begins his inquiry by looking at particular beings. A horse, for example. Of that being, he asks two questions. Whether or not it is, and what it is. A traditional way to phrase this is to say that substance is both the that-ness and the what-ness of a thing. In the case of our horse, that it exists and that it is a horse combine to constitute the substance of the horse. Primary and secondary substance. Aristotle calls the first sense of being the primary substance. Particular beings in themselves, self-sufficient instances of discrete existence that depend on nothing for their existence, other than the prime matter out of which it arose in combination with the form imposed upon it at generation. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The next installment will discuss this in more detail. So, Socrates is a substance, that pen in your hand is a substance, the sun is a substance, and Flea Biscuit, the racehorse, is a substance. They're all primary substances insofar as they are independent subjects about which various things can be predicated, and of which they are never predicated of any other things. For example, that Flea Biscuit is your pen, or that Socrates is a flea biscuit. For Aristotle, the science of metaphysics is the science of giving things their right names. In practice, then, metaphysics, at least in part, is the process of moving things from a state of being to a state of being named. A substance becomes a subject when it is assigned a noun. And the two ways that nouns can be assigned demarcates the boundary between primary and secondary substance. Socrates, flea biscuit, the Parthenon, that pen, item number 36248 in your Amazon shopping cart, and you are all proper nouns, and therefore primary substances. But what could we give as a name that would identify the secondary substance of a being? What could be said of Socrates that would be indicative of Socrates, but only in a general sense and not particular to his being alone? That name would move us from the that-ness of Socrates to the what-ness of Socrates. We want to know not only that Socrates is, but also what he is. We can answer this question by saying of Socrates that he is a man. In other words, we can predicate a universal of him. He belongs to a class of similar beings called mankind. That class is the secondary substance. Species and genus. Aristotle further divides secondary substance into two kinds, species and genus. Before continuing, a quick note of caution is in order. Though he was an avid naturalist and protobiologist, Aristotle does not use these terms in the Linnaean or genetic sense as we do today. Rather, Aristotle is dealing with categories of thought, things grouped together on account of the similar things that can be said of them. So Socrates, Pericles, Speusippus, and Oedipus are all particular subjects, but also members of the species man, because we would all say of them that they are two-footed, featherless, rational animals. But we'd also say that the pen in your hand is both a subject and a species. It is a subject because it is an individual being, and it is a species because it possesses attributes that are indicative of a class of beings, writing utensils. But the pen in your hand is not the writing utensil. It is one among millions of individuals of which we can say similar things of all of them. Cylindrical, tipped with a liquid that sticks well to paper, fits comfortably in the hand. In other words, it is a member of the species of writing tools. Aristotle recognized that it was possible to say of a being more than one thing. In the case of our pen, that it is a writing tool and that it is an artifact. In the case of Socrates, that he is a man and that he is an animal as opposed to an artifact. This higher order attribution is what Aristotle calls the genus of a being. This way of saying something of a subject is still a kind of secondary substance predication, because we are still dealing with a universal classification. It is a more general concept, however, because it includes both individuals and species. Again, Aristotle is working with categories of thought, not genetic lineage. However, it is true that the relation between genus, species, and individuals is hierarchical in nature. A species can never be an individual, in the same sense that Socrates is a man. Likewise, Socrates cannot be man as such. He can only be a man, and obviously the genus animal cannot be either the species man or the individual Socrates, though it does contain both of them. Properties, or the other categories. How is it that we come to say of Socrates that he is Socrates, or that he is a man, as opposed to a seashell or a pen? What is it that makes a pen a writing tool or an artifact? These questions signal the dividing line between substance and the rest of the categories. It is not my intention here to catalog all of the remaining 9 categories. That'll have to wait for another time. Suffice to say that, for Aristotle, it is the nature of a thing that determines the whatness of a thing, and the nature of a thing is determined by what can be found in that thing. For example, that Socrates was short, or had Socrates' snub nose, or spent his days in the Agora in Athens, or had Socrates' white beard, or suffered Socrates' demon-haunted conscience. All of these are things that are particular attributes of Socrates marked him out as Socrates and are only found in Socrates. If he did not exist, then neither would his snub nose, his white beard, nor his demon-haunted conscience. The individual attributes, in other words, are entirely dependent upon the substance within which they are found. As dependent particulars, the properties of Socrates would only exist while Socrates existed. But we should be careful to make one further distinction. Socrates' particular snub nose is not snub-nosedness. Socrates does not have snub-nosedness. He has a snub nose. The white in Socrates' beard is particular to Socrates, but also an instance of the universal property of whiteness, since it is present in the substance to which it is being predicated. This notion of universal property is the closest analogy in Aristotle's theory to Plato's famous forms. But unlike his mentor Plato, Aristotle insists that the universal of a property would not exist without at least one particular instance of its expression present in a being. If no individuals were expressing the color white in their beards, there could be no such thing as white-beardedness, and no such property could be, or reasonably would be, predicated of any subject. To make this point clear, try to imagine the fanciful property schlurbness. What would a thing that has schlurb look like? How would it behave? To what species of substance could we assign schlurb as a property? If one thing did exist that expressed the characteristic schlurbness, these questions would all be easily answerable. Thus, all of the categories after substance rely in some sense on substance for their existence. But substance itself stands alone as something that is in nothing, though in the case of secondary substance, may be said of primary substance. One last point of clarity is needed here. Secondary substances are thought to be universal in some sense, as are universal properties. Are secondary substances dependent upon primary substances for their existence in the same way that the properties are? This can't be the case, since even the secondary substances are independent of their individuals. The species man need not rely on any surviving individual man for it to exist. We would simply pass into speaking of mankind in the past tense. Likewise, the species unicorn has independent existence whether or not any particular unicorn exists or is being imagined. To speak of one is to speak of something, albeit imaginary. Whereas to speak of the pink in the unicorn's mane or the hardness of its horn is to speak of properties that would be extinguished as soon as our imaginations moved on to something else more entertaining. Extended discussion. From this outline, we can conclude that Aristotle was what we moderns would now call a nominalist, relative to his old master Plato. What this means in a nutshell is that Aristotle believed that the existence of abstract objects like universals, for the most part, are reliant upon the particular individuals that expressed the property being generalized. Plato, on the other hand, believed that a realm of eternal perfection was home to ideal forms of not only all the qualitative and quantitative properties, but of all individuals as well. Everything in the world, according to Plato, is a sort of forger's copy of these perfections. Or, perhaps, that all particulars were participatory expressions of that singular form of perfection. This put Aristotle at direct loggerheads with his old teacher. For him, everything begins with the particular, both the particular individual and the particular property. These particular entities exhibit consistent patterns that we are able to recognize as rational animals. And it is these patterns that constitute our universal concept as a product of reason. You might say that Plato was a top-down ontologist, while Aristotle was a bottom-up ontologist. This is actually the basis for the famous depiction of the two masters in Raphael's School of Athens. Plato points to the sky while Aristotle gestures at the ground. Aristotle's bottom-up approach is admittedly a powerful tool for understanding the world around us, in particular, our subjective experience of that world and how we are able to make sense of it. It is Aristotle's nominalism that was the inspiration for scientific inquiry for the next 3,000 years, and the basic assumptions of that nominalism still permeate today's modern science, especially the assumption that the world is patterned and predictable, and that these patterns are discernible by a rational process of observation and interpretation. But it is precisely this assumption that remains a problem for Aristotle and his nominalist approach to metaphysics. The first question of the philosopher is not how, or even what, but why. Aristotle never thought to ask why this basic assumption always seems to hold. He sought only to provide an account of the things that exist from that assumption. This more fundamental question was what Plato was targeting. He eschewed the examination of horses and shellfish, not because he thought there was nothing to learn from that examination, but because that knowledge was only derivative of what the philosopher ought to be paying attention to. Studying individuals may give you a vast knowledge of the varieties of the forms, but it won't tell you why that knowledge is possible or even whether the forms are the right theory for why everything isn't just, as William James put it, a blooming, buzzing confusion. Conclusion. In any case, we've drifted far afield from where we began. So it's time to put a bow on this episode. The goal here was to show what Aristotle meant by substance in the categories and to outline why it is distinct from and fundamental to all the other categories, whatever they may be. In the next installment, we'll visit the topic of substance once again, only this time from the version provided by Aristotle in the Metaphysics. I've sprinkled in a few concepts from that in this essay, so this next installment should help to clarify those insertions. Then, after we're thoroughly confused by that, we'll take a look at Michael Wieden's book, Aristotle's Theory of Substance, to get a look at how we might stitch the two versions of substance back together into a coherent whole. So stay tuned for that, and until next time, see you then.